Yeah, I think those lights are a little too bright. Could you? Thank you. Yeah, that's better. Would you please let me know if I'm inaudible in the back now? I'm inaudible? Okay. Better now? Okay, good. The title of this lecture is Time and Nature in Lucretius's De Rerum Natura, that is, Time and Nature in Lucretius's On the Nature of Things. The course of the lecture can be articulated in four parts: theme, development, recapitulation, and coda. The theme states Lucretius's conception of time in two different ways: in a philosophical definition and in poetic metaphors of time. The question about the relation of definition and metaphors leads over into the development of the theme, into an inquiry about the meaning of nature, the key term in Lucretius's De Rerum Natura. The connection between theme and development might not be immediately obvious, but the recapitulation shows that Lucretius's conception of time depends on his conception of nature, and that the two aspects of definition and metaphors of time depend on a double aspect of nature, depend on nature as being and nature as appearances. The coda takes off from the results of the recapitulation, from the connection between nature and time, and restates the theme in terms of man's relation to time and nature. The quotes about time in Lucretius's De Rerum Natura are so many, and most of them so complex, that for the purposes of this lecture, I'm going to restrict myself to very few. Those few, however, I'm going to use over and over in order to consider them on the different aspects. Time and nature in Lucretius's De Rerum Natura. Part 1, theme. In book 1 of De Rerum Natura, in the context of discussion of properties and accidents of things, Lucretius defines time as accident of motion. Quote, "Even so, time exists not by itself, but from things themselves comes a feeling what was brought to a close in time past, then what is present now, and further what is going to be hereafter. And it must be avowed that no man feels time by itself apart from the motion and quiet rest of things." Unquote. The two distinguishable aspects of time are, one, its dependence on motion and rest of things, and two, its dependence on human perception. Epicurus, in his work on nature, had defined time as, quote, "Phantasia tis kinesios pases katametretike," unquote, as a certain measuring perception of any motion. In Lucretius's definition, however, where sensus and sentire, where feeling takes the place of phantasiatis katametretike, of a certain measuring perception, the measuring aspect of the human perception of time seems to be lost. This difference from Epicurus in definition, as far as the one distinguishable aspect of time, its dependence on human perception is concerned, appears to be heightened in the body of the text with respect to the other distinguishable aspect of time, its dependence on motion and rest of things. Throughout Lucretius's philosophical poem, time is spoken of as space, as motion, and as force, most compactly in the line of Book 5, quote, "Sic volvenda aetas commutat tempora rerum," unquote. Thus, rolling time changes the times of things. In the course of this lecture, two related questions will have to be clarified. One, what is the connection between these three different metaphors of time, between time as space, time as motion, and time as force? And two, what is the common ground for this poetic view of time and a philosophical definition of it as accident of motion? Lucretius's account of time as space ranges from general to particular and from quantitative to qualitative meaning. Things happen in time in smaller or larger amounts of time, or things have their times, their youth, their maturity, and their old age. The dependence of time on bodies in motion through space seems to be transformed into a correspondence between spatially extended motion and time, expressed metaphorically as space of time. The notion of time as space with a mere quantitative meaning ranges from infinitely great to infinitely small, most paradoxically from the whole of time to the point of time, and thus mirrors the sum of things, always the same and not the same, infinite matter, infinitely in motion, through infinite space. Time as space, however, is mostly conceived with a qualitative as well as quantitative meaning. Things not only happen in time, in smaller or larger amounts of time, they also have their times, their youth, their maturity, and their old age. The most striking example for this usage is the account of the birth, growth, maturity, decay, and death of our world at the end of the second book of De Rerum Natura. If we keep in mind that time had been defined as accident of motion, and that in the expression space of time, it had been substituted metaphorically for the space measured through by motion, the coincidence of quantitative and qualitative meaning of time has to be understood as a correspondence between a phase in the motion of a body through space and a space of time depending on this phase of the motion, but now expressed as phase of the moving body itself. The safeguarding condition for this substitution of the accident time for the body in motion is the occurrence of motion in accordance with fixed laws. Quote, "I teach by what law, the law of nature, all things are created, and how they must needs abide by it, and how they are not strong enough to break through the powerful laws of time," unquote. These laws, sometimes called the laws of nature, sometimes the laws of time, determine the phases of the different spaces of time, which quantitatively and qualitatively distinguishable, make up the life of a body in motion. The perception of different phases within the lifetime of a moving body leads to the second metaphor of time, to time as not only space for motion, but also motion itself. Motion of time appears most naturally in connection with the motion of heavenly bodies, where at times the heavenly body, at other times the time determined by it, is seen in motion. The other most striking example stems from the account of man's cultural development and combines all three metaphors of time, time as space, motion, and force. Quote, sic volvendi tas commutat tempora rerum, unquote. Thus rolling time changes the times of things. The natural or cultural change of things can be grasped in three aspects. One, the different phases of the development are determined quantitatively and qualitatively by the metaphor space of time as tempora rerum, as times of things. Two, the dynamic character of the succession of different phases is caught in the metaphor motion of time as volvenda aetas, as rolling time. And three, the cause of change inherent in the nature of things is recognized in the metaphor force of time as volvenda aetas commuta tempora rerum, as rolling time changing the times of things. This means that the whole phenomenon change in its three aspects, cause, mode of being, and effect, is mirrored as time. Time as force seems to be the one metaphor most remote from the Epicurean understanding of time as accident of motion. It nevertheless is the one which occurs most frequently in Lucretius's De Rerum Natura. Change appears to be caused both by forces inherent in things and caused by the force of time. Quote, we perceive all things flow away, as it were, in the long lapse of time as age withdraws them from our sight. And, quote, if time utterly destroys whatsoever through age it takes from sight, unquote. The comparison of the two quotes shows that first, age in the long lapse of time, then time through age seems to affect change in things. The space of time, which has to be measured through by things subject to change, is conceived as having changing influence on them. Quote, for infinite time and the day that has gone by must needs have devoured all things that are of mortal body. But whatever has been in that space and gone by time, out of which this sum of things consists and is replenished, is certainly endowed with immortal nature. This powerful influence, sometimes called the forces of measureless time, is not only seen as a general impact on things, as infinita aetas, as infinite time, but also as a particular impact, graspable in successive moments of time, as ante acta dies, as the gone by day. The destructive force of time appears to be so strong that things are imagined to suffer under the torments of time. Quote, again, do you not behold stones too vanquished by time, high towers falling in ruins and rocks crumbling away, shrines and images of the gods growing weary and worn, while their sacred presence cannot prolong the boundaries of fate, nor struggle against the laws of nature. Again, do we not see stones torn up from high mountains, rushing headlong, unable to brook or bear the stern strength of a limited time? For indeed, they would not be suddenly torn up and fall headlong if from time everlasting they had held out against all the torments of time without breaking." Unquote. The force of rolling time changing the times of things is finally spoken of as changing the nature of the world. Quote, "For time changes the nature of the whole world, and one state after another must needs overtake all things, nor does anything abide like itself. All things change their abode. Nature alters all things and constrains them to turn. For one thing rots away and grows faint and feeble with age. Thereon another grows up and issues from its place of scorn. So then, time changes the nature of the whole world, and one state after another overtakes the earth, so that it cannot bear what it did, but can bear what it did not of old." Unquote. Part two, development. In order to, one, clarify the connection between the three different metaphors of time, and two, discover the common ground for the poetic view of time and the philosophical definition of it, we will have to consider the relation of time to nature, the key term in Lucretius's De Rerum Natura. Inextricably connected with change of things, force of time in motion of time through space of time cannot act outside or against nature. Change of things, whether growth or decay, occurs under the laws of both time and nature. Quote, "I teach by what law, the law of nature, all things are created, and how they must needs abide by it, and how they are not strong enough to break through the powerful laws of time." Unquote. What does it mean to speak of time, as in the last quote of part one, changing the nature of the whole world, and of nature changing all things? Epicurus, daring to go beyond the flaming walls of the world and to break open the tight locks of the gates of nature, came back victoriously with the knowledge of what can come to be, what cannot, finally, how each thing has its power defined and its deep-set boundary mark. Nature, as the totality of being and non-being, of coming into being and going out of being, is matter in motion through space, which brings forth birth and death of things. Quote, "Come now, I will unfold by what movement the creative bodies of matter beget diverse things, and break up those that are begotten, by what force they are constrained to do this, and what velocity is appointed them for moving through the mighty void. Do you remember to give your mind to my words? For in very truth, matter does not cleave close packed to itself, since we see each thing grow less, and we perceive all things flow away, as it were, in the long lapse of time, as age withdraws them from our sight. And yet, the universe is seen to remain undiminished, inasmuch as all bodies that depart from anything lessen that from which they pass away and bless with increase that to which they have come. They constrain the former to grow old and the latter again to flourish, and yet they abide not with it. Thus, the sum of things is ever being replenished, and mortals live one and all by give and take. Some races wax and others wane, and in a short space the tribes of living things are changed, and like runners hand on the torch of life, unquote. On the basis of this creative and destructive force, nature herself seems to be above the process of matter in motion through space. However striking this impression might be, Lucretius never tires of reminding us of the truth that nature only explicates the hidden characteristics of matter. Matter in motion through space results, however, in definite ways of growth and decay, a fact which allows for terms like fudera naturae, bonds of nature, or pacta naturae, pacts of nature. Quote, the bodies of the first beginnings in the ages past moved with the same motion as now, and hereafter will be born forever in a similar way. Such things as have been wont to come to being will be brought to birth under the same condition, will exist and grow to be strong, inasmuch as is granted to each by the bonds of nature, unquote. The problematic character of expressions like in a similar way and such things as have been wont to come to being will be brought to birth under the same condition indicates, however, that the bonds of nature provide no more than a framework for experimentation of matter in motion through space. Quote, for in very truth, not by design did the first beginnings of things place themselves each in their order with foreseeing mind, nor indeed did they make compact what movement each should start, but because many of them, shifting in many ways throughout the world, are harried and buffeted by blows from limitless time, by trying movements and unions of every kind, at last they fall into such dispositions as those whereby our world of things is created and holds together. And it too, preserved from harm through many a mighty cycle of years, when once it has been cast into convenient movements, brings it about that rivers replenish the sea, and so on, unquote. What can be the criterion for convenient movements in a world too faulty to be created by gods and continually engaged in a war between life and death? The repeated example of nature trying but being unable to create monsters suggests that convenient movements must mean stability of growth, maturity, and decay. The formula for nature, what can come to be, what cannot, finally, how each thing has its power defined and its deep-set boundary mark, is explicated in the account of certain matter responsible for things coming into being and going out of being at certain times. Most compactly, it is stated as materiae concursus motus ordo positura figurae, as meetings, motions, order, position, and shapes of matter. The order of these terms follows the order of the process of recognition from complex mobility to simple stability. Our senses perceive the reality of motion and rest of things. This reality our mind uncovers as deceptive appearance, as atoms ceaselessly in motion. The true rest, however, underlying that restlessness and establishing the conditions for the achievement of convenient movements is to be found in the shape of atoms. that shape of atoms bears special importance for the nature of a thing can be seen from its central position in Book Two, the book about motion and rest. I put something up here on the board. Diagram of what I'm going to say in the next few minutes. After the proemium about motion and rest in terms of body and mind, a positive treatment of motion and rest in terms of atoms leads over into the discussion of shape of atoms, which in turn gives way to a negative treatment of color and feeling in atoms. The finale describes the sum of things in motion and rest, but now not in terms of atoms, as in the three main parts of the book, but corresponding to the proemium in terms of compounds, of worlds being born and dying. Thus, Book Two shows a symmetry of pairs, motion and rest, grouped around the one, rest. The one being shape of atoms, the pairs being motion and rest in terms of compounds in proemium and finale, and motion and rest in terms of atoms in the first and third main part of the book. Even though in the context of this lecture, an elaboration on details of structure must seem a digression, it nevertheless strengthens the argument for the special importance of shape of atoms for the nature of a thing. Quote, "Then, at the birth of the world, a sort of fresh-formed storm, a mass, gathered together of first beginnings of every kind, whose discord was waging war and confounding interspaces, paths, interlacings, weights, blows, meetings, and motions, because owing to their unlike forms and various shapes, all things were unable to remain in union, as they do now, and to give and receive convenient movements." Unquote. Differently from Platonic or Aristotelian usage, though, where shape, eidos, idea, or morphe, means shape of or for a thing, in the Epicurean context, all the factors, materiae, concursus, motus, ordo, positura, figurae, play their part in determining the appearance of a thing. Part three, recapitulation. The inquiry into the meaning of nature, the key term of Lucretius's De Rerum Natura, aimed at clarifying the relation of nature and time, and consequently, the relation of the philosophical definition and the poetic metaphors of time. The relation of nature and time becomes especially poignant in a passage from Book One, where both concepts, time and nature, are coupled into one. Quote, "Lastly, whatever day and nature adds to things little by little, impelling them to grow in due proportion, the straining sight of the eye can never behold. Nor again, wherever things grow old through time and decay, nor where rocks overhang the sea, devoured by the thin salt spray, could you see what they lose in time. By bodies unseen, then, nature treats things." Unquote. If one considers at first beginning and end of this statement, quote, "whatever day and nature adds to things little by little," unquote, is restated in, quote, by bodies unseen then nature treats things, unquote. The double force, day and nature, corresponds to one force, nature, using the other force, bodies unseen, in order to effect change. Change of things occurs in time and through time and decay, that is, both from within and from without. Day, in the double concept day and nature, presents itself before nature, since it is the force of time which makes us reflect about the force of nature, since it is the change of appearances which makes us reflect about the permanence of being. The term day, implying a small, quantitatively and qualitatively defined unit of time, reminds us of the fact that change of things occurs in small steps, continually altering the parts of the sum of things. The sum of things, however, is held in balance by the permanent laws of nature. Time, reflecting change within the sum of things, is an accident of motion. As such, it is an accident of nature, since nature comprehends the whole scale of meanings from the creative and destructive power governing the world to the laws of growth and decay determining the world, derived from the movements of atoms. Dies naturaque, day and nature, therefore, represents two aspects of one and the same truth. Dies, day, stands for the changeable aspect of appearances, the measurable actualization of infinite matter in infinite motion through infinite space. Natura, nature, stands for the unchangeable aspect of being, the firm laws of infinite matter in infinite motion through infinite space. The three metaphors of time, force of time, motion of time, and space of time, correspond to the three aspects of nature, matter, motion, and space. The interchangeability between nature and time, between substance and accident, explains itself through man's being more concerned with change than with permanence, and therefore more with time than with nature. Similarly, birth and growth, decay and death, are not presented equally under the influence of nature and time, but birth and growth more under the influence of nature, decay and death more under the influence of time. Once life has begun, man seems to be most concerned with its meaningful completion and therefore with time affecting change towards that end. The relation of time and nature in Lucretius's philosophical poem can be grasped in another comparable pair of terms, in the relation of fortune and nature. Subsequent quotes describe first nature, then fortune as governing the world. The context, however, makes it clear that fortune is neither an equal nor rival force to nature, but that governing nature provides the framework for governing fortune. Nature determines the general laws of the world, fortune only the particular moves possible within those laws. Similarly, the relation of nature and time, of substance and accident, was shown to consist in the relation of matter in motion through space, and force of time in motion of time through space of time. The connection between the three aspects of nature, therefore, becomes the key for the connection between the three metaphors of time. The one-to-one correspondence of the three pairs indicates the special importance of matter under the aspect of nature, the permanent, and of force under the aspect of time, the changeable. The fact that force explicates matter as time explicates nature is the common ground for the poetic view of time and its philosophical definition, is the common ground for the metaphorical use of time as force, motion, and space, and its definition as accident of motion. Theme, development, and recapitulation of this lecture try to understand how time as accident becomes interchangeable with nature, the substance of the world, which also entailed the substitution of the definition by metaphors of time. To understand how does not, however, mean to understand why this substitution takes place, a question to be answered by considering the second aspect of Lucretius's definition of time, its dependence on human perception. Part 4, Coda. The first aspect of Lucretius's definition was time's dependence on motion and rest of things. Quote, "Even so, time exists not by itself, but from things themselves comes a feeling, what was brought to a close in time past, then what is present now, and further, what is going to be hereafter. And it must be avowed that no man feels time by itself, apart from the motion and quiet rest of things." Unquote. The second aspect, time's dependence on human perception, implies both man's awareness and man's evaluation of time. Man's awareness of time, coming from things themselves, stems from things of nature as well as things of human nature. The reason for distinguishing between these two, though connected, realms is man's different evaluation of time, whether nature or human nature is concerned. Within nature as a whole, where the sum of things through the constant cycle of life and death is always the same and always not the same, and where development in time eventually means turning back to the beginning, time seems to become more and more negligible the more one moves from the parts to the whole. Within the context of nature, quote, "We perceive all things flow away, as it were, in the long lapse of time, as age withdraws them from our sight. And yet, the universe is seen to remain undiminished, inasmuch as all bodies that depart from anything lessen that from which they pass away, and bless with increase that to which they have come. They constrain the former to grow old, and the latter again to flourish, and yet they abide not with it. Thus, the sum of things is ever being replenished, and mortals live one and all by give and take. Some races wax and others wane, and in a short space the tribes of living things are changed, and like runners hand on the torch of life." This indifference of time and nature with respect to any human content of life moves man to resist nature for the sake of life. Quote, "But even granting that I knew not what are the first beginnings of things, thus much at least I would dare to affirm from the very ways of heaven, and to show from many other facts, that the world was never made for us by divine power. So great are the faults wherewith it stands endowed. In the first place, of all that the sky covers in its mighty movement, a great part is possessed by greedy mountains and forests full of wild beasts, part rocks and vasty marshes hold, and the sea that keeps the shores of its lands far apart. Well nigh two parts of these lands are robbed from mortals by scorching heat and constantly falling frost. Even the land that is left, nature would still cover with brambles by her own power, but that man's power resists for the sake of life." Unquote. The difference between the description of the newborn child crying in its helplessness and the young animals largely taken care of by nature herself does not mean resignation before nature, but recognition of the need for development in the case of man. Quote, "One thing I feel able to affirm, so small are the traces of different natures, so small are the traces of different natures left, which reason could not dispel for us, that nothing hinders us from living a life worthy of God's." Unquote. This task of man, to overcome the indifference of time and nature with respect to human life, takes on two, though related, forms. One is man's detachment from temporal things within his own lifetime. The other, man's overcoming the temporality of his own life by seeing himself as part of mankind and the development of his own nature as part of the development of the nature of man. Lucretius's description of the development of man in Book 5 of De Rerum Natura ends with a rather complicated statement of the principles of change. Quote, "Practice and therewith the experience of the eager mind taught them little by little as they went forward step by step. So, little by little, time brings out each several thing into view, and reason raises it up into the coasts of light." Unquote. As a quote from Book 4 shows, usus, the first impelling force towards progress, means practice in the sense of both action and reaction. Similarly, only enables him to control and change nature for the sake of life, but also reflects back on his understanding of himself and his relation to other men, that is, on his control and change of human nature within nature. The emphasis on human mind or human reason, in addition to human action and time as principles of change, reveals the difference between nature and human nature in their respective development. In nature, matter in motion through space affects convenient movements, stability of growth, maturity, and decay. In human nature, man, having a body, falls under the laws of all compound bodies, that is, the laws of growth and decay. On the other hand, having reason, he not only has to choose the steps of his growth, but he also has to find limits for bodily as well as spiritual needs, limits which will keep him within convenient movements, that is, within the framework of human nature and its fulfillment. This wisdom to know the limits appropriate for man's nature is the prize which elevates Epicurus, the new god of culture, over the old gods, Ceres, Bacchus, and Hercules, who only dealt with bodily needs. To know the limits appropriate for human nature means to know the limits for controlling and changing nature for the sake of life, both human nature and nature as a whole. The prospect of the death of our natural world, which will set an end to any historical development of human nature, whether positive or negative, make man reflect on time more with respect to his own life than with respect to the life of mankind. As Lucretius claims in Book 3, quote, "One thing I feel able to affirm, so small are the traces of different natures left, which reason could not dispel for us, that nothing hinders us from living a life worthy of gods," unquote. The one thing the gods are not concerned about is time and death. The position of books 3 and 4, the books about man, between books 1 and 2, the books about the microcosm of atoms, and books 5 and 6, the books about the macrocosm of worlds, shows man's special position within the sum of things. Being in the center between microcosm and macrocosm, he is at the same time part of the cycle of time and nature, and able to detach himself from it on account of his reason. Man's mind and soul enable him to be aware of time, to be aware of the measurable aspect of nature. Aware of nature and time's role within nature, man becomes aware of death, more so than of birth, since the end to the fulfillment of human nature is more significant than the beginning of its promise. The exhortation of personified nature to overcome the fear of death in the finale of Book 3 means, in more general terms, exhortation to overcome the fear of the end of time and, implicitly, the end of motion. The proemium of Book 2, the book about motion and rest, praised the task of the Epicurean philosopher to gain rest over motion through the power of mind, enabling him to evaluate the needs of body and mind, and therefore to set limits for himself in accordance with human nature. The fact that Book 3 explains the nature of mind and soul in terms of bodies in motion through void makes one at least wonder about the chances of the mind ever to gain rest over motion, and therefore to take on an attitude towards time which would render it as negligible for one single life as it appears to be for the life of the sum of things. In the finale of Book 3, nature, always present and representing the unchangeable aspect of being, tries to convince man that time, never present, neither as whole nor in its parts, and representing the changeable aspect of appearances, is negligible as far as human life is concerned. In other words, personified nature tries to convince man that time is only an accident of matter in motion through space, or finally, an accident of nature. This means that the poetic metaphors of time, force of time, motion of time, and space of time, are to be reduced to its philosophical definition. Quote, "Even so, time exists not by itself, and it must be avowed that no man feels time apart from the motion and quiet rest of things," unquote. Time changing the nature of the whole world, and nature changing all things are therefore not interchangeable terms on the same level, but one time subsumed under the other, nature. The personification of nature in the finale of Book Three is balanced by the deification of the poet in the premium of Book Four. I tried to make a little diagram of the different books. Will be about what's in picture here. Okay. The personification of nature in the finale of Book Three is balanced by the deification of the poet in the proemium of Book Four. Both passages together form the center of Lucretius's De Rerum Natura. The finale of Book Three, the bitter harangue of nature, lets us taste the wormwood. The premium of Book Four, the joyful prospect of fame for the poet, lets us taste the honey. Though together, reversing the order of first offering honey and then wormwood, both passages have counterparts which affirm that order, namely first honey and then wormwood. The bitter finale of Book Three, the description of death, has its counterpart in the sweet proemium of Book One, the description of life. The sweet proemium of Book Four, the description of the highest achievement in life, has its counterpart in the bitter finale of Book Six, the description of the ruin of everything worth living for. The fact that the center of the six books, for once, lets us taste the sweet honey after the bitter wormwood might mean that even the bitterness of death, if understood in Epicurean terms, can be considered sweet. The thematic sequence of death in the finale of Book Three and fame in the proemium of Book Four seems to reflect the necessary connection of nature and time, of that which is always the same and refers to the past, and that which is always different and refers to the future. Man's awareness of time without the awareness of nature distorts his view of the relation of motion and rest within the sum of things. Man's awareness and evaluation of time, on the other hand, constitutes his awareness of nature and is therefore crucial not only for his understanding of himself as part of the whole, but also of the whole itself. The fact that nature's and the poet's voices mark the center of Lucretius's work bears out the everlasting tension between nature encompassing all and man striving to encompass nature. Thank you.